Okay, well, I start with what Greenham Common was. It was an RAF base in the last World War, and the RAF, the Royal Air Force, had promised to return it to the people of Newbury because it was on common land, which is land that belongs to all the people, and certain people who live near it have rights on it. But at the end of the war, that didn't happen. The Americans came in, NATO came in, and took it over. And they tried to have quite heavy aircraft on it, but the runway gave way, and a lot of people complained about the noise. So they then decided to use it for the cruise missile program. Some of you will know about the cruise missiles. The idea was they were these extremely powerful little weapons that were mounted on lorries and driven around on the roads. They were to be stored in silos, sort of semi-underground, in the base. And then, at times of international tension, they were put into special launchers, and they were to be driven out to melt into the countryside. And we had television programmes explaining to us how we were to feel so safe having these little weapons, terribly powerful little weapons, melting into our countryside, so that if the Russians or whoever the enemy was supposed to be wanted to get rid of them, they'd have to blow up the whole of southern England. So naturally enough, we felt personally threatened by them, as well as not wanting to be pointing weapons at people we didn't feel any enmity for. So a number of us felt strongly against this, and at that time I was living in England, but a woman in Wales called Anne Pettit had an idea to walk from Wales to Greenham Common. And she got some people together. As it happened, they were mostly women. There were a few men supporting as well. So they all set off from Cardiff, I think about their numbers varying from about 30 to 50, and stayed in various church halls and so on the way. And they had no intention of staying when they set off. They were going to meet with the press, organise to meet with the press, and then demand from the government a televised interview so that they could put their point across. When they got to Greenham, their request was just completely ignored, and they felt fairly angry. They were received no publicity at all. So some of them decided to stay, and people lent them tents and gave them caravans, and they set up a little camp outside. And that's how it started. This was in 1981, the 5th of September 1981. For a while, it was, although it was mainly women, there were a few men there. And the idea was it would be led by women, but men could be slotted in. But I wasn't there when this happened, but in February 1982, a meeting was held to discuss whether it should continue to have men or whether the men should be asked to leave. And I think this was around the behaviour of two particular men whose behaviour women had criticised for various reasons. And the decision was made then to ask them to leave, and from then on, Greenham became women only. Men were welcome to visit during the day and to talk and so on and to support, but not to stay overnight. So it was a women only venture. Fairly early on, the local government started organising evictions of the camp. So they could only do this every few months. And at first the camp was on local authority land, so when the local authority... Oh, please join us. Have you come for the workshop?
Do I see that? I think it's a tin of boot polish. Taste like...
Right. We have started the workshop.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Because it's now 3:20, and it's sort of started at 3-ish, well, a bit after 3. So what I'm doing at the moment, this is being taped, I'm giving a factual history of the camp, and I'll go on from where I got to. Apologies to people who haven't heard the beginning. The taping is going to stop when I get on to the next bit after the factual bit, because I want to be fairly frank. We've got as far as the first evictions in 82, I think May 82. So when the camp was evicted from local authority land, they moved on to Department of Transport land by the road, and vice versa. So when the Department of Transport evicted them, they moved back. So the local authority had to think of some other way to get rid of the camp, because this was too easy. We were just toing and froing. We had, when I went, which was in August 1982, there were caravans still, and there was quite a lot there. And then in October 1982, they got together and had a big eviction and took the caravans away. So we were left with nothing. We had nowhere to live. We had thought a bit about it before. The weather was terrible. It was raining. We tried sleeping under bits of plastic. And then eventually we started building benders. I'm sure most of you know what benders are. Anyone who doesn't. Do join us. Welcome.
Two people don't know.
We were surrounded by trees. And with trees like willow and hazel, you can cut off, especially if it's been coppiced, you can cut off one branch of it without killing the tree. So you've got a sort of bendy branch. If you cut a number of bendy branches, you'll see a bender at the back down there made of willow. You stick them in the ground, tie the top, and then we went to the local gardening shop and bought thick plastic to put over the top. And then various refinements, carpets. Benders became quite posh, and some women even brought their entire wardrobe from Scotland or wherever, hung up their petticoats and lovely clothes in their benders. So we were living fairly well again. Then the local authority decided to come to change the law so they could come every day with a sort of rubbish van. You know, the van they put rubbish in, we called it the muncher because it sort of munched our property. So Tilly knows all about this. They'd come sometimes once a week, sometimes four times a day in bad weather. They'd come and take all our property and put it in the muncher and put our fire out. And still we didn't go away. We could put things in a van and drive away. They couldn't move us from our bodies physically because we had a right to be there, but they could take our property. Anyway, we weren't just sitting around surviving, living in benders, we were taking action. When the camp started, the cruise missiles hadn't yet arrived. In November 1982, the first loads of equipment came for the cruise missiles. And we planned a big action, a very big action, for December the 12th. We started planning it when we still had caravans and a typewriter. So luckily we got most of the basic invitations out, and we sent them sort of round robins, photocopy 10 of these and give to friends, and each friend would photocopy it. And because it seemed to be exactly at the right time to pick up on public feeling, we thought maybe a few hundred will come. And it was quite depressing preparing for it because it was muddy and we had nowhere to live, and very, very hard work. And then 30,000, more than 30,000 came, women and men, people of all sorts. And there were enough to completely encircle 9 miles of fence. And It was just amazing. We just sort of, we tried to organise it, we just let it organise itself, and then because we were exhausted, we had no office, we just let it go ahead, and it went well. And got quite a lot of press, and quite a lot of good press at that point. After that, the press became very unpleasant, because when you're successful against the state, obviously they come back at you from all fronts, and we had been very successful. At some point, we had this big discussion, was it violent to cut the fence? And now it seems ludicrous. Was it violent to cut a fence? So it wouldn't think twice about it. But in those days, it was quite a big subject for discussion. And in the end, we decided it was perfectly okay. We got bolt cutters.
Yes, bingo!
Thank you. Thank you for that.
And the only reason you came, isn't it?
Oh, you've got a light. Oh, light, dear.
Finished.
Bolt cutter. Can we
being
all share it? What
man,
it is.
You're a sharing person.
Anyway, we practiced with these bolt cutters and we got quite good with them. And of course, once women started, they were chopping and going in all the time, and there were women in and out of the base all the time, taking and driving away Land Rovers, washing their coats in the laundrette inside the base. And the base just couldn't cope. They got British Army to be all the way inside, on the inside, and British police all the way outside, so helicopters flying overhead. Once the cruise missiles arrived, the security was stepped up, and it was a horrible place to live. At the main gate, we were all at the main gate in those days, but as it came nearer to the time we expected them to be deploying the cruise missiles, we were worried that they'd send the convoys of lorries out from one of the other gates, or from some gaps in the fence that had been prepared, so they could roll the fence back in certain places. So women decided to form camps elsewhere. There was Green Gate, which was a sort of rest gate because it was never evicted, and then Blue Gate was set up on the other side of the base, and Orange Gate, and so on. In between little gates would appear indigo, turquoise, scarlet, red. More and more colours of the rainbow would get slotted in, and we had really huge numbers of women all round the base. Things we did, we never got as far as disarming the cruise missiles themselves. Women would spray paint the buildings and the vehicles if they could get to them inside. One woman put a potato in the exhaust pipe of a cruise missile launcher, which then stuttered to a halt. Spud.
Stuttered to what?
Stuttered to a halt. You know Spud. She stuck a potato in the... And so she did actually cause it to break down on its way to Salisbury Plain. They decided in the end that they couldn't just take these lorries anywhere. They had to take them to Salisbury Plain, which was already a designated military area with lots of little copses in it, because farmers and so on, I mean, people just weren't ready to accept having a lorry full of cruise missiles on their farm or whatever, and it just wasn't acceptable to the British people. So every time they went on exercise, they went to Salisbury Plain, and they would go on exercise once a month. All this time, women had been taking action. Huge numbers were going to prison all the time. The first large lot that went to prison got into some trenches. They were building new sewers for the base, and a lot of women got arrested there. And they made the mistake of trying a lot of women at once and sending them all to prison at once, which was... We then had a peace camp outside Holloway Prison and lots of publicity. And two small prisons said they would never have Greenham women again because they couldn't cope with them. And an open prison had a showing of an anti-nuclear film, and all the prisoners had a wonderful time. We were making a wonderful effect on the women's prisons. So of course then they made they were very careful not to imprison us in large numbers at the same time. So we tended not to go to court in big numbers. So far it was mostly fence cutting and trespass inside the base and blockades outside the base as workers were going in and so on. And after the exercises started, we would follow the cruise missile convoy. There was also a group, a mixed group, which was fairly male-dominated, called Cruise Watch, who would follow the cruise missile convoy and find out which cops on Salisbury Plain it was going to. So we would go generally at night, and you could hear the cruise missile convoy in action when it was on exercises. It made a very distinctive sound. So we'd go at night to sort of where we thought it might be, and then you'd hear it, and there'd be a big rolls and rolls of razor wire round it, and that it would be in a clump of trees with armed American soldiers. And then we'd come up to it. We might set off a tripwire, which would send up a flare and would be lit up. Then we'd start shouting, "Blood on your hands! Shame on you!" and singing, and all these men with guns looked pretty scared, really. That would always lead to arrest. So we got quite a lot of charges for criminal trespass on Salisbury Plain. But it did disrupt these exercises that were supposed to be attacking the rest of the, practicing to attack the rest of the world. I don't think they ever really had a sort of uninterrupted practice for killing masses of people, which was what they wanted to do. We had quite a number more big actions around the base, and gradually numbers began to dwindle. We became less popular. At one time we had this terrible press where they were making us out to be absolute slags, was the word, dirty lesbians and slags and child abusers, and the gutter press just called us everything and were disgusting to us. And on the other hand, we were these sort of angels of the peace movement. I was in a Quaker meeting at the time that tried to idolise me, and I very strongly resisted being idolised. So I had to say stop it, because if you're not an angel, what's the point of being told you're an angel? It just makes you sick. Another thing, before the convoys started, a very important thing was the night watches around the base. Women's peace groups from all over the country would come, really sometimes a long way, to sit up all night and watch in case they brought the convoy out. So we'd have women staying up all night all around the base at every gate watching. And later on we came to know, we knew the signs when they were going to bring the convoy out. It was about once a month. And you could see from, you could climb a ladder and sort of look in and see that they were ready to come out. So then we didn't need to do that anymore. The whole movement became completely anarchic when we had the huge numbers. When I first went, there were women that you might call respectable, I suppose, who wanted everything to be very organised and to have rules and so on. But once they started evicting us and we were living out of doors and packing up tents, because they would evict our benders after a while, we had to live in tents that we could pack up every day. We couldn't keep on living in benders. You cannot be organised when you're living like that, and anarchy just rules. It's just too hard. And you have these big rows and it's really hard. I moved from Yellowgate because I really got worn down by it. But on a good day, it would be wonderful, because when anarchy sort of becomes really, when there's good energy and everyone's sort of working together without rules, I can't explain the experience of it. It's wonderful. And unexpected things happen that you haven't planned for. And sometimes they're good, sometimes they're worrying, but sometimes they're very good. Women had all sorts of different bases of struggle when they came to the camp. We had women who were interested in animal rights, we had women in political parties, We had women of absolutely all ages, from runaway teenagers to in their 80s. We had women that weren't interested in the peace movement at all, but had nowhere to live or had mental health problems, who just needed a community to be with. And that sometimes was very problematic because we couldn't really nurture people in those circumstances. And we also had women from all over the world, visitors from all over the world. We were funded from Sweden for a long time. Thank you, Sweden. Money was a big problem because the money was abused in some ways. I got so I couldn't go to the money meetings because people would be claiming money for things and you knew that it wasn't being used for what they were claiming it for. And there was no structure in which to challenge this, and it became very frustrating. But on the whole, I think I also feel strongly now, as the years go by, I'll ask Tilly what she feels later. I feel we succeeded, that this was a sort of success, that you can say it had a start and it had a successful end. And I think that is something that I really hold on to. The official reason for the cruise missiles leaving was that the nuclear non-proliferation treaty was signed. And that they were sort of argued away. They were we'll get rid of the cruise missiles in this non-proliferation thing, and we'll sort of reduce our weapons. But another factor was that they never want to talk about that certain women, when they took action in the base and were charged, would use as their defence that they had a lawful excuse because the bylaws were valid. Michael Heseltine had changed the bylaws on the common because it was common land. These local laws had been changed illegally because they'd been done quickly and carelessly. So this case went up the courts. It was appealed up through the Crown Court and the High Court and then to the House of Lords. And the House of Lords found in our favour that we did have lawful excuse because the bylaws were invalid and that the base was actually illegal. Because under the original bylaws, they weren't allowed to put up fences, they weren't allowed to fire missiles, and they weren't allowed to erect buildings, and they'd done all those things. So, and that was our work, did that. So now I suppose I'm in a state of evaluating the experience, because women stayed there for quite a while and we closed the camp officially this millennium with a big party and a fire, and it was lovely, although a caravan is still there. We stayed there and took action at Aldermaston and also fought for the status of the common to try and stop them just using it for development and nothing else. And now we're happy with that because half of it is a nature reserve and the other half of this is to be used for small local businesses. So I think we succeeded there, and we feel all we need now is to make a commemoration of our work, a stone circle on the common with a fire in the middle made of metal. And that has been designed, and it's on the website, so if anyone wants to take a leaflet, they can see the plans. And we've got posters. I think I'll stop there and take questions.
Should I stop?
We'll go on. We could take on for the questions.
You said there was huge numbers of people going to prison. Do you have any idea of how many?
Oh, I mean, just there'd be one or two court cases every week, and court cases would have to be shunted out to Oxford and Reading, and some women would. It was just non-stop. Women were going to court all the time. Just huge numbers. What would you say, Tilly? I mean. I would say
I'm too busy laughing at a situation. We should tell everybody what we're laughing at, because otherwise it's
what is it?
Yesterday we were having a conversation around the bonfire about how when Jennifer was doing it, how always men were always asking, you know, about numbers, how many people this, how many people that.
How many groups did that?
So we just made this observation that men were always going on about numbers.
And also, this was a thing that happened at Cambridge, wasn't it? We would constantly have people coming trying to count us, and we counted.
So they would have the statistics.
Yes, ask them.
But I would think thousands of women went to prison at different times over the 10 years. I would think so.
I don't know,
but I think that would be, and a lot of the same women went again and again and again. There weren't a lot of long sentences. I think the longest was a year when someone actually did 6 months. Anne Francis and Katrina did 4 months. So it wasn't huge long sentences like you get in the States. It was not so bad.
Can I ask a question about the nature of this, whatever it is? There were two things on the timetable. One was talking about, well, there were two sheets on the timetable, both in your handwriting. One was talking about looking at the bad sides of us. Is that something that's coming up later? Or is that
no. When we started the workshop, sort of shortly after three, I asked the people who were here then if it would be all right if I changed that, because I had planned some talking about criticizing, sort of criticisms of co-workers. I think we've gone too much into that already in this camp, so I felt I didn't want to go into that really, just more to look at our own behavior and motives really, and yes. Any other questions on the facts?
I'm very interested by the numbers of people involved. Not the numbers, but I mean how it was possible to mobilise and energise and empower like tens of thousands of people. And I wondered if you could give some idea of what was happening outside. How was what you were doing there being amplified through a wider movement such that it could have that level of support?
Well, a lot of towns and cities had Greenham support groups, which were very often women only. And women of all ages and all types were finding they really did like to work in a women-only space. And so we got brought a lot of food. And also there were mixed groups that supported us, a lot of political parties that supported us. We were just very fashionable because we gave people hope, I think. Any group that wanted change felt they got hope from seeing that we were starting to change things. We got criticised by supporters as well.
I have a question along that line. For me, it's such an incredible symbol of Greenham, especially the thing of staying there year round with the case. How was it possible to create that kind of commitment that people are staying in the freezing winter? For me, it's kind of impossible to understand that.
We were sort of called there. I've discussed this with friends who will, and I don't know if Tilly feels the same. But we felt we were called to come there. Something brought us there and made us determined to stay there. So I think the people who... I was very careful. I had a council flat in Oxford, at Wood Farm, and I kept that and I signed on in Oxford. So I'd stay at the camp for 2 weeks. I go back, sign on, have a bath, wash the clothes, and come back again. So I sort of have 2 days off and 2 weeks over signing on. So I sort of kept myself safe. Other women, it amazed me, they would drop everything. They'd have no other home and they'd come and live there, not even able to have a bender, having to have a home, some sort of collapsible home or tent that they could stuff in the back of the van when the evictions came. And I can only say women become very determined. I can't explain why, but women were very motivated to stay there. And I remember once in the snow, at Violet Gate it was, and a woman brought a squeeze box and we all started Morris dancing in the snow. We were having a wonderful time. Meanwhile, the other person was nicking our bedding from where we put our tents on the other side of the road. So we went to bed in the snow to find we had no sleeping bags. And yet we didn't go away. We sort of managed to borrow sleeping bags from women who'd left them, who'd gone away for a few days or so on, and we adapted. And that's the sort of motivation we had. Would you like to say something about that too?
Yeah, I didn't have nearly the commitment of a lot of the women there, because I didn't stay there in the winter. I arrived in late spring and stayed until it started to get cold in October. And I did spend one or two weekends down there, but it was really, really cold and I woke up and the place was frozen and stuff like that. But I couldn't pick it. Too uncomfortable for me. It's really, really hard.
I think we seem to have only a quarter of an hour left. Are there any more questions? Can I then suggest this exercise? This is where the tape recorder goes off, please.